Hey, it's Talia here, and welcome back to I Got Back Up. In every episode on the show, I chat with an amazing guest about their story, but I never really tend to share mine in full. So on today's episode, that's exactly what I do, as I chat with Sam Harris on his podcast, Growth Mindset.
One of the most brilliant quotes from history is from the Dalai Lama when he was asked what surprised him the most. His reply was, of course, man, because man sacrifices his health in order to make money. Then he sacrifices his money to recuperate his health. And then he is so anxious about the future that he does not enjoy the present. The result being that he does not live in the present or the future. He lives as if he's never going to die, and then dies having never really lived. And that quote, I think, encapsulates such an important idea that truly gets to the root of many of our problems. Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, a near-death experience can often be a major catalyst for growth that wakes people up to the fact that there is no second attempt at life where they can correct all their mistakes and finally live with more vibrance and colour and embrace the dreams that they were afraid to pursue their first time around. So for this episode, my guest today is Talia Lazarus, and she had her own near-death experience. And for the last 2 years, she has run a podcast called I Got Back Up. Within it, she interviews humans about their own near-death experiences, how it impacted them, how it changed their lives for the positive, and what practical lessons we can all implement in our life from that. She certainly has her own tale of growth. Talia was pursuing a successful career in the city when one day she was quite literally run over by a bus. During her recovery, she slowly deconstructed basically her entire life and ended up making small but powerful steps in the direction of her dreams and who she wanted to be, and has now become a sports presenter working on her own terms without a boss. She's a really inspiring person, and we ended up having a brilliant conversation on what a growth mindset truly is and how we can fool ourselves into thinking we have one, and what are the ways that we can uncover the lies we tell ourselves, and what are the tools that we can use to rapidly increase our mindset and our potential. Sadly, we all have a tragically short life, so finding those tools that can trigger us to fulfill our capabilities and the upper limits of our potential is so important, because so many people never even realize what they're capable of. So on that, I hope you enjoy this inspiring episode with the one and only Talia Lazarus. So let's start with the concept of growth mindset. And what does growth mindset mean to you?
It's definitely one of those things which I think everybody experiences it very differently. But I think growth mindset definitely happens around certain situation events in people's lives that can completely change their perspective on life in general. And it's the ability to kind of sit back and look and think to yourself, okay, I'm where I am in my life right now. I'm doing things I'm doing right now. You know, am I okay with this? Probably, yeah. But could I be better? Could this thing be better? Could I be living my dreams? If I decided to change things in aspects of my life, can I grow? And when you grow, I mean, amazing things only happen from then onwards.
Yeah, definitely. I think a key part word that I think you're implying but didn't state is like the responsibility of yourself to make that growth.
No, it is. It's 100%. A growth mindset, it's your mission for yourself. People can tell you to do it. You can watch other people do it, but you make the decision at the end of the day to grow or not. It's like anything in life. It is down to you. And if you want to accept that it's time to grow, or you're ready to grow, or you want to change things, it's you against you, really.
Yeah, like, I feel like a lot of people think they have a growth mindset because they're like, oh, I just like improving at stuff. But you don't really realize that mostly it's realizing that you're bad at stuff and accepting that you need to take responsibility for doing the difficult bits, rather than like, okay, I know that if I'm good at languages, I can just start doing some languages and I'll get better at them. It's more like, okay, what are the things you're really bad at? Or what are the things that you're good at, but you're not addressing the things that you find difficult, et cetera? Or how can you completely change your life by changing how you perceive everything? Which is why I kind of like asking this question. Each guest has a different interpretation, usually based on some kind of story that like taught them how to be more growth mindset. Because of, I'm sure you thought you had a growth mindset around how you're living your life, but then that changed a bit after you were hit by a bus and you sort of came at life a bit differently afterwards.
Yeah. And I think it actually summarizes what I was said just before, was that my life was pretty all right before. I would have been more than happy doing what I was doing before, doing my life. And now I'm 2.5 years on from my accident, which I'm sure we'll go into. I just didn't realize how much more to life there was. I had absolutely no idea until my accident and everything that's followed afterwards. And I liked when you said it's you have to take responsibility. A lot of people think they're growing and a lot of people think they're doing things which are, in inverted commas, right. And it's not just going, okay, cool, I'm going to learn a new language today. It's, okay, this thing triggers me. This thing scares me. This thing makes me cry. This thing makes me anxious. Okay, why? And do you want to dive into that and figure it out? So you can start working through that and you can grow from it.
On that, what did happen to you in terms of your accident? Because of otherwise it might be a bit confusing for people listening. And yeah, what were the effects? What did you learn? How has it changed your life?
August the 23rd, 2021, I was riding one of those stand-up electric scooters that everyone sees whizzing around. And I basically lost control and I hit the bus. Ironically, I think the bus saved my life, because if the bus wasn't there, I would have gone straight into oncoming traffic and I think it would have been a lot worse. So that's what happened. Yeah, I know, in hindsight. Thank you, bus. So I was, you know, thrown off the scooter into the middle of the road and I was kind of tumbling around with the scooter. I was picked off the side of the street by complete strangers. And kind of that was the moment where I remember looking down at my leg and I knew that something was wrong. I just knew. This wasn't great. This was terrible, actually. And I just remember screaming. I was in shock. I couldn't breathe. I was kind of picked up by the strangers and put onto a chair on the side of the road. And there was loads of people around me, kind of obviously talking to me, offering me water. I was just in shock. I remember I could hardly speak to anybody. And someone said, "Do you want to call an ambulance?" And I was like, yeah. So the ambulance turned up and they bent my leg and I thought, great, nothing's broken. And they said to me, "Do you think you can walk to the ambulance?" And I remember I looked at them and I said, "Well, do you think I can walk to the ambulance?" And they said, "Yeah, I suppose so." I put both my arms over the paramedic's shoulders. I took one step on my left leg and my ankle went one direction and my knee went the other direction and my leg came back together like a piece of cooked spaghetti. And I looked down at it at the same time. So I saw it, which has been one of the hardest things to process moving forward. Had I not have looked down and seen it, it might not have been so bad in certain ways, but I looked down and I saw that happened. And believe me, that you're not meant to see that happen to your leg. Like, you're just not. And I was, you know, I was rushed to hospital. I had done a full rupture to my ACL. I had done a grade 3 tear to my MCL and I had done a bucket handle tear to my meniscus. So someone actually said to me, it was like I had taken a mallet to my knee and bashed it to pieces. Literally, there was internal bleeding, a bone bruising. I mean, it was chaotic to say the least. But that's kind of the extent of what happened. It's funny because some people ask me what exactly happened when I fell off the scooter. And sometimes I think my brain still's blocked it out. All I remember is once I hit the bus, and obviously I was panicking, I put my left leg down, obviously to stop. I couldn't stop the scooter. I don't know why. I put my left leg down. And I guess the impact of putting something like my leg down stationary while on something moving just threw me into the air. But I'm going to be completely honest, I didn't have a helmet on. So that's when everyone goes, "Oh, what? That's so daft of you." And I know a lot of people have told me I didn't have a helmet on. So not only am I very lucky to just be walking, but I'm very lucky to be alive, is how I see it. And that's definitely something I've taken into consideration moving forward. I'm very lucky to just be alive.
I definitely can relate. I broke my femur kite surfing and it went to like spaghetti. It's such a weird experience when your body is like, it's suddenly no longer yours, because like my foot and like below my knee was all still together, but it was just tied to me via a completely messed up sort of femoral area that was just a bit of a bag. And it was so odd and horrendously painful. And you're just looking at this like thing floating in the water that's like technically yours, but you're like, I have no association with this thing. Like, it's like a jellyfish is just sitting in between my hip and my knee. And what is going on? Yeah, I definitely relate to the sort of weirdness. I definitely have much greater appreciation for my limbs and just the amazingness that they all just work and are intact, and how crazy it is that everything works. Sometimes I'm just like, just the concept of a single cell just splitting enough times to become a human of like 30 trillion cells is like just nuts. But when you have actual things which involve some major trauma to one part of your body, is usually the biggest effect.
I remember that evening when I got back, I remember looking down at my left leg, because it was my left leg. And I just remember looking down and not feeling like it was a part of my body. Then I remember at the time someone saying to me, is it broken? I said, no, I think it's ligaments. And they said, oh, you'd rather it be broken. It was like, really?
It depends on how broken it is, I think. A normal break's good. But yeah, I lost like a whole inch of leg. So I wouldn't recommend that much breaking. But yeah, I was really surprised that I lost length of leg from things being put back together. But anyway, so after this, then having had like a major event, it can disrupt a lot of people's worldview in general, in terms of, as in people talk about like going to therapy or having like psychedelic experiences that can like disrupt the patterns in your brain of like how you make decisions and just what pathways you have. And interestingly, total side note, but I was doing like an episode on attachment styles, and people that have avoidant attachment styles, right? Like the biggest way to solve someone's avoidant attachment style is to give them a near-death experience, and they're more likely to realize that actually seeking some kind of perfect partner that doesn't exist isn't going to work out for them, and that maybe they should be grateful for what they have, which is like kind of interesting. Yeah, it's serious.
Wow. Maybe I should, you know, text a couple of, you know,
Often without a helmet. Yeah. I did also add a caveat in my episode being like, if you are anxious attachment style or anything, don't try and like hospitalize your avoidant partner. Yeah. Like, probably illegal.
Yeah, don't try this at home, but it might help.
Just done correctly. But anyway, point being, wild traumatic experiences can be very disruptive to your like thinking patterns. And so how did your thinking patterns change afterwards, and how did that result in like what you're doing with your life?
Oh, my whole life changed. Let's say my life was going left before, and now it's going in the polar opposite direction. And I know a lot of people say, well, was there a single moment when it changed? Was there a light bulb moment? I don't think there was. I think what happened was I just went to the depths of darkness. You know, I don't know if you watch Friends, but there's that phrase that Rachel says in the first season, when Ross shows back up at the airport with a new girlfriend, and she says, you know, she's like all the way to the bottom of the darkness and 20 feet below, you know, rock bottom. And what I did was I somehow single-handedly decided to burn every single aspect of my life to the ground, clear every single slate without realizing I was doing it. At the time, I'd also decided to quit my job. I did it on a hunch. I also did it after I was heavily medicated for 2 weeks. After my first surgery. So I'm not sure if that was playing a part, but I did it.
What I wanted to talk about was the concept of like small improvements and the way that things add up over time. And same with habits and stuff. As in, it's not like you did one thing that suddenly went from like Talia, the person with a normal job, to Talia, the sports presenter. You kind of made small little decisions, some of which were maybe kind of big as well, but stacked on top, that kind of has changed you over time. And then like one of your podcasts where you spoke to lots of people who had been through similar experiences, like it's obviously going to then like push you to do more things in that direction. The same way that Running the Growth Mindset podcast has definitely pushed me to learn a lot more about like my own areas of growth that I thought I was already good at, and being like, oh, actually I'm an idiot. In every episode, I'm like, oh, I can get even better at this thing, and I'm still probably not that good. So besides quitting your job, what were the kinds of things that you did, and perhaps like why did you feel that you didn't want to stay in your job anymore? What was wrong with it compared to before when you were happy with it?
So there was nothing in inverted commas wrong with it, because before my accident, I probably would have stayed there, would have stayed in the company. But I think what happened was during the 2 weeks I was at home after my first surgery, I just started writing. I always liked to write, and I started writing about the things I couldn't do currently. So I'm a qualified climbing instructor. So I used to do that at university, and I started to write about climbing. I started to write about traveling. I started to write about things I couldn't physically do, which led me on to think, okay, I was like, I want to be a journalist. I literally was like, I want to be a journalist. I want to write. I want to write for a living. And I was actually in a content role at the time. So I was like, yeah, I got this. Like, I write anyway. So there wasn't a plan. There was just I think I want to be a journalist. And I know some people don't necessarily always feel this or understand this or get this, but there was a feeling inside me, which I still can't explain. It was almost in my soul, which was like, Talia, like you have to quit. It was like a gut feeling, I guess. And, you know, my intuition, Talia, you have to quit. And I've never quit a job without another job lined up ever. Never, ever, ever. And I think one of the reasons I realized I wanted to do this, I wanted to go freelance. I wanted to start working for myself. And one of the other things I realized about it as well was, you know, I was traveling to my physio, who was an hour away from mine, the Lewin Clinic, they're called. And I was with them for an hour every, you know, every session. So it was like an hour there, an hour session, an hour back. And this was in the middle of my work day. I'd have to message my, you know, if I suddenly got an appointment that day, I'd have to message my manager and be like, look, I have to take 3 hours out this afternoon because I have to go to physio. He was incredible. He was like, yeah, sure, just go. I was like, oh, thanks. But it was also that ability of knowing that, like, say things came up in life, constantly having to, you know, message your manager. By the way, I have to this. By the way, I have to. My whole life, I always had this feeling of like not wanting to be in an office 9 to 5. I just couldn't for the life of me figure out what it was. I thought at one point I was going to be a climbing instructor in the Dolomites and, you know, live my best life in Italy. And I think it was just a mixture of different things, which was like, Talia, just quit your job and let's do this. So that's basically what I did. What happened was while I started doing all the writing, I then started to talk to a couple of my friends who'd been through their own stories while I was kind of really going through mine. And I started to write up their stories and I started to post it on a blog, which I then called I Got Back Up. And what I noticed was I was sharing these guys' stories and they were so appreciative, bearing in mind they were my friends, but they were so appreciative that I was giving them a platform to share what they'd been through. And giving them a voice. And then other friends and family that were reading them were like, wow, if this person can do this, it kind of motivates me to want to do that. So that's when I started to think, okay, maybe it's not a journalist per se. Maybe there's more to this that I'm, you know, meaning to do. So again, it's one of those things where you, I think you said before, it wasn't one decision. It was an accumulation of different things that just kept happening, which led me on to the ball started to roll.
More coming up after the break. But firstly, this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. And they want you to ask yourself, what is the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in the day? Would you go for a run, take a nap, read a book? Many of us wish we had more time, which is something we've been talking about in this episode. But what for? The best way to squeeze that thing into your schedule is to know what's important for you and to prioritize it. Therapy can help you find what matters to you and do more of that thing. Personally, I found therapy with BetterHelp really did help me to stop running around like a nutter so much and make peace with some of the things I thought I wanted to do and do more of what I actually enjoy. If you're thinking of starting therapy, then BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/growthmindset today to get 10% off your first month. That is betterhelp.com/growthmindset. I am delighted to be sponsored by LinkedIn Jobs. Hiring for a small business is very important. You want people that will do the thing and who will also help those around them do the thing. And so the right hire is crucial. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools that will help you get your task of hiring done faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It's a vast network of more than a billion professionals giving you access to talent that you can't find anywhere else. In fact, 86% of small businesses found a qualified candidate within 24 hours of posting their job. And that is why 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/growth. That's G-R-O-W-T-H. linkedin.com/growth to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
And then it was the beginning of 2022 and I stopped everything because I was coming up to my second knee surgery and I was kind of on the climb upwards to a good place. And then I went straight back down. But it was a really tough time mentally because you hear people say this, but I'd look in the mirror and I'd have absolutely no idea at the girl looking back. Like I had no idea who she was. I'd look down at my legs and I wouldn't even feel like they were part of my body. They didn't feel like me. I mean, lost is even an understatement. I would cry anywhere. I'd sit with a friend for coffee and cry. I'd cry in the middle of the gym. Like I'd cry in my car. I was in such a bad place. And I think that's almost what happens when you're at rock bottom and 20 feet below. There's nowhere else to go. I had my second surgery, which was really tough because they decided to operate on both my legs. And I never forget waking up and looking down after surgery and seeing both my legs operated on. And that was tough. I was 25 and I just remember looking down and being like, what is happening? Like, both of my legs have been operated on. Like, what is happening? And the reason I'm saying all of this is because I think it was around April, May time when I started to come back to life, in inverted commas. I was like a shell. I basically dropped off the face of the earth for maybe 6 to 7 months. I just disappeared. Like, I disappeared. I even deleted my old Instagram account. The only people that knew what was going on were the people I chosen to tell, which was my best friends, my close friends, and my family. That was it. I had people, you know, a year later being like, I had no idea what happened to you. And I was like, yeah, that was the point. I think I was so concerned of just getting through every day, just surviving. I haven't even got many pictures because I think all I wanted to do was just survive every day and get through the next day.
Yeah. I mean, when people come to you and they want to just ask you how you are and like give you sympathy the entire time, it's like, it's not helping. Talk to me about like the things they always would talk to me before. It's okay. But certainly when I was in the hospital, I just had such a headache. I couldn't even talk to anyone. It was like a very meditative state of just a pain cave, I'd say, for my hospital experience. But yeah, talking to people about those things was just a bit like annoying.
I hated when everyone was like, how are you feeling today? And I'd be like, yeah, I'm fine. Anyway, like, tell me about your day. And everyone was like, Talia, you're really positive. They were like, why are you so positive through this? And it's the classic, oh, you know, if this was happening to me, I'd never be able to be as strong or as brave as you are. But something I've learned from that. And then again, on my podcast, loads of people have said this as well. Loads of people have had people say that to them. But if you are unfortunately put into that position for whatever the position may be, you are strong enough and you are brave enough, because when strength and bravery is the only thing you've got, you don't realize how strong you are until you have to be.
People actually get to that point, as in the human instinct to survive and carry on and do stuff is just really strong. And then people can do things. A tough, annoying thing that's also put to my brain is how useless my body is actually in the survival instinct when some things have happened. Like, I've given up on trying to live a few times, in terms of when my leg happened, like after 5 minutes, I was just like, I can't move. I can't swim. I'm just going to float off the coast of Africa and die. And that's fine. I made peace. Turns out someone came and like fished me out and dragged me back in through the sea. So that was nice. Or I capsized my kayak in the middle of winter in Wales once. And like, I was underwater for quite a while trying to get out the kayak because it was like pinned against a bridge and the river was like pushing me backwards. So I couldn't get to the thing. So by the time I then finally got out of the kayak, my body was already so cold that I couldn't swim. So I was just floating down this river, also expected to die. And luckily the guy that was leading us, who actually had broken ribs at the time, managed to like get to me. And I kind of just about hung onto his kayak and got dragged out of the water again. But again, like, my body was failed. Like, I did have at least the intention of trying to get out, but I couldn't. Yeah. Adrenaline did nothing for me.
Fight or flight comes in. And I mean, but you do hear that a lot. Sometimes fight or flight comes in and someone freezes, you pause.
But like, physically, depending on what's going on, so like, if your body is that cold, like, you can't do anything about it. Adrenaline doesn't care, has no impact on muscles that are so cold that they can't move. Like, you will die in freezing water in 3 minutes. Like, it doesn't matter how cool you are. Otherwise, your body is really strong and does carry on, and like, people can always do a crazy personal best in terms of how far they've ever walked in their life if they have to, which is really cool. And then the concept that like, most people never reach their potential in so many things in life because they just never get tested. In terms of the Roman army, it was just a bunch of peasants who became the soldiers, but then they just marched across freaking the entirety of Europe with loads of heavy stuff on their backs and became absolutely solid. And like, anyone could put on a terrible backpack and walk with crappy shoes across Europe, but like, they don't think they can. But anyone can do that. And you can do like crazy amounts of things. Like, it wasn't like the genetically superior people of Rome. They were just like told what to do and they went and did it because they had to. So anyone could be just as fit as they were. It's not something special about you. It's just like the human genetics will let you do that if you push yourself.
Oh, 100%, 100%. And actually, an example on what happened with me. So I had my second surgery, the ACL one, so the double knee surgery, in February the 25th, 2022. And that December, 10 months later, I signed up for a half marathon. I was still in recovery. I was only doing interval sprints, if that, 30 seconds on the treadmill at the time when I signed up. And the reason being I'm saying this is because when I used to think before my accident, the idea of a half marathon or a marathon, I used to laugh and be like, yeah, nah, I'm okay. Like, I'm good. I don't want to physically and mentally put my body and my mind and my soul and my spirit through that. It's impossible. Like, I'm never going to be able to do that. I used to literally look up even half marathon runners and like worship them and be like, wow, that's amazing. Like, I could never do that. And for some reason, I decided that December, right, you know what? It's me against me. I want to challenge myself. I'm going to do this. And I messaged my physio before I signed up. I messaged him and I said, there's a half marathon in 4 months' time. It was April the 2nd. Do you think I have the physical ability to do this? You know, yes or no? And he went, yeah, you'll be good. I went, okay. And there we go. I got my place with a charity 10 minutes later. And I'd say it's one of the toughest mental and physical challenges I've ever been through, because I'd never run further than 10 kilometers before that. That last 10K was like 4 years prior, 4 years before. And I wanted to show myself that not only can I run a half marathon, but I can do it after two knee surgeries. It wasn't just the finish line at the end of the half marathon. It's the journey. It's the process. It was every step along the way. So that first time I ran more than 10 and I did 11K, I was blown away. The first time I then ran 12K, I was blown away. And it was like every single step that I kept doing afterwards to take me to the, obviously, the finish line. Mentally, I'd, you know, wake up on a Tuesday morning and just hit the gym and run 10 kilometers. And I was like, wow, who is this person doing that? And it goes in what you were saying is you think you can't do these things. You think they're impossible. You think, you know, only superhumans or superheroes can do them, but you really can put your mind, your body will tell you it wants to give up. If you listen to it all the time, you will give up a lot sooner than you think. It's the mind. If you tell yourself you can't do something, you can't. If you tell yourself you can, then you can. So if you're on that treadmill and you think you can't run that 12K, and you get to 10 and you're like, okay, I'm too tired now, but it's two more. If you tell yourself you can, you'll get those two extra K. It's anything in life. If you tell yourself you can, you can.
Limits are just all in our mind. Most of these things that we think are like, oh, this is, can never happen. It's, sure, it might be quite a few jumps that you don't know about to get to the next thing, but like it's totally doable for most aspects of life. Going back to something that you mentioned earlier around the concept of the frustration you had feeling like you had to constantly ask your manager for approval to do things. I feel like a lot of people are waiting for someone to say that they can do something before they then go and do it, and realizing that actually, like, no one's going to make you quit your job and follow your dreams. Like, you are the person that's going to do that. No one's going to say, yeah, go try that without you actually just giving the permission to yourself to go and do these things.
I 100% agree with you though, because the only person stopping us is ourselves. Okay, there might be reasons you can't do something because of, you know, something else or somebody else. But most of the time, the things that are stopping us is us, whatever it might be. It is us. And you're right. Who says that you can't just quit your job tomorrow and follow your dreams? Okay, I understand there's probably things like financial requirements, and I get that entirely. But there are ways that you can do things on the side to start. There are ways that you can do things, you know, whatever it might be. You want to sign up for a half marathon, you can train. If you want to have a side hustle, just start today. It's one of those things where everybody waits for the next day. You wait for tomorrow. You wait for, maybe I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it in a week. I'll do it in a month. I'll do it next year. I'll do it when I'm happier. I'll do it when I'm more peaceful. I'll do it when I'm in a better headspace. But there's no right time in life, because I think we spoke about this before. I hit a bus, right? And you know the classic line, you never know what can happen every day. You could get hit by a bus. Yeah, I hit a bus. So I do live in that sort of mindset. You know, if there's something I want to do, or a text I want to send, or an email I want to send, or don't get me wrong, I do sometimes think I'll do it tomorrow. But then it, depending on what it might be, sometimes I have to snap myself out of it and be like, yeah, but what's the point, Talia? Why wait till tomorrow when you can literally do that thing right now? Just start today. And the reason why a lot of us don't do it, it comes down to fear. We're scared. We're scared of the outcome. We're scared of the answer. We're scared of the reaction. We're scared. What happens if it doesn't work? Yeah, but it's not what if it doesn't work. What if it does work? Like, what if your dreams come true? What if everything amazing and even more begins to happen? And what I've started to see as well was by doing things like that, like, you know, not only do your dreams start to come true, but dreams you never even dreamt start to happen. And you're like, wow, like, this is my life? Like, wow. All because you decided to take that step out your comfort zone for that 1 second. Sometimes all you need is 1 second.
Because saying on the concept of like, you don't necessarily need to know the whole journey to get there. There can be quite a few unknowns, but it's, you just have to start doing something. And there's a concept called the doorstep mile in like adventure. And the concept basically refers to the fact that the first mile is the hardest. Like, even the person that cycles around the world or does anything like this, is it's actually this, just getting out the bloody door and starting is the hard part. And sure, maybe you don't want to cycle around the world, but doing a podcast or something, just deciding to start it and do something small about it actually isn't in theory that hard, but actually just sort of making yourself decide to go and do it is. And once you just get better at just doing these small things, it just all adds up over time when you don't know where it's going to take you or who you're going to meet or what lessons you'll learn that will then change how you think about doing something else afterwards.
100%. But I'm sure you might have had that when you started your podcast, because I know when I started mine, you know, so my podcast, which is called I Got Back Up, the reason I started it was because, like I said, I had the blog at first and I was transcribing the interviews because I would do them over the phone to write them up. I was listening to these interviews and I was like, wow, these stories shouldn't just be read. They need to be heard. And that wasn't an overnight decision. Don't get me wrong. I didn't just wake up the next day and go like, right, I'm going to start a podcast. I sat back for about a month or so and was like, oh my God, like, am I about to start a podcast? No, not me. Like, am I? No. There was a lot of to and fro for a really long time. I'd say about a month or so later, I did. I got three different friends, you know, for an episode each to start. And that was it. I was starting a podcast. And now I'm four seasons in and over 60 episodes. But again, it's one of those things. And I'm sure you had it when you first started your podcast. It was one of those, okay, well, I'm just going to hit record and just go. Like, I'm just going to do it. I have to just do it.
And yet it also was like 9 months from when I first recorded an episode to when I actually finally started publishing things. Just sort of getting over things like actually working out how to do an introduction and the stupid stuff that sort of held me back, but slowly getting through it. And then, yeah, every year I felt like I learned something different and changed quite a lot in the podcast. And yeah, would never have imagined that I'd end up doing what I do now in terms of it's mostly stuff that I write or think about on the podcast rather than me interviewing people. And that would have been super weird for me to even like to someone tell that to me. I'd be like, what? Why? Who wants to listen to me? I can't write and I can't speak. So why would I be doing either of these things? But that's actually something that I really enjoy doing and is the part of the podcast that sort of works the best. And yeah, who'd have thought?
But they're just the self-limiting beliefs that, you know, or they're the insecurities. It's like, who's going to listen to me? Like, I can't do this. I can't, you know, write. I can't, whatever it might be. You don't know unless you give it a go. You don't know unless you try.
Having interviewed 60 people who've all had kind of life-changing experiences, what were some of the biggest lessons that you've taken away from them?
One of them that really stands out for me is with a guy on the show called Derek Daly, and he is a former Formula One and IndyCar driver. So back in the 70s and 80s. So that story in itself, listening about motorsports back then to how it is now, it's very different. You know, we spoke about himself and he was in, you know, terrible crash. But the thing that resonates from his story the most for me is he says, there's no point spending too much time looking in the rearview mirror. Obviously, in motorsports, is, you know, what's the point? You know, when you're driving, there's no point spending too much time looking in the rearview mirror. But you take that into life. Obviously, there are things in the past maybe people want to change, people regret, people dwell on. But there's no point spending too much time focused on what's behind you, because it's behind you. You know, you can do so many different things by not focusing on it, but by talking about it or getting through it or processing it, accepting it, something, you know, is therapy, for instance. But there's no point spending too much time focused on what has happened, because if you're constantly stuck looking in the past, that's the only place you're going to stay. You have to focus on the drive ahead, the road ahead, what's right in front of you. And that takes you into the present moment, focusing on not too much into the future and into, you know, on the road ahead, because the path can go anywhere. But on that next step in front of you, on that kilometer or that short distance ahead of you, there's no point focusing too much on what's going on in the past. You have to focus on today.
Super useful to learn from experiences and take that forwards. But I think people can go into these things with the wrong mindset, which would be a fixed mindset, obviously, as opposed to growth mindset. And things like psychotherapy, where you go into your past experiences and like unresolved traumas and stuff, can often like limit people when they like find an excuse for their problems. Or same with like attachment styles. Like people like might learn about their attachment style and how it was given to them as a child, and then they'll use that as an excuse to then do all the bad parts of their attachment style, as opposed to trying to learn about it, how they can fix it, or come with like a more open-minded way of how to be in a relationship.
And that's the growth mindset. You can learn about your attachment style, we all either know what we have or, you know, we're still figuring it out, or we can learn about our past and traumas and things like that. And you're right. You have two decisions. You have the decision to just make it an excuse and to sit with it and be like, yeah, but this is me. I'm going to get on with it. Or you can go, okay, this is me, but I'm not just going to get on with it and use an excuse. I'm going to figure out. And I think this is kind of what I touched on at the beginning. I can figure out a way to heal from it, to learn from it, to grow from it, to go, okay, this happened in the past, but maybe let's not use it as an excuse. Let's figure out how it can change for the future, because I want to heal. I want to grow. I want to be positive. I want to whatever it might be. And I think that's the thing. You have two decisions. You have the decision to sit with it, or you have the decision to not, and to dive right into it.
The separation between your behaviors and your actual being, as in like you are not your behaviors. And the concept in Buddhism of every day, the molecules and everything that makes you up like change, like each second that passes, like you are technically a different person. And like, there's nothing right now that says that you should do anything like you've done before going forwards. And there's nothing that makes you have to do that. You're choosing to do all those behaviors again, and you can go through life completely differently. Obviously, radically changing your life every single second would be a bit too much. But the point is, you don't have to be held into previous patterns or problems. And it's very nice and liberating when you're like, oh, okay, it's entirely my responsibility to not do this thing rather than having the convenience of being able to make an excuse about it. But it is nice to know that you can do stuff, which is powerful. What, if anything, did people outline as their biggest mistakes that you've interviewed in life, perhaps?
It's funny because I don't think many people spoke about mistakes, because, you know, I'd always either ask the question or they'd bring it up themselves, which was, if you had the choice to go through what you'd gone through, would you not? Maybe one or two might have said no, but even then, everyone kind of went, I would still go through it for their own personal reasons. You know, and some stories were really tough. Not that it's a mistake, but I think what a lot of people kind of would say is that they didn't realize, everyone can feel very alone. You can feel really alone going through what you're going through. And I think, not that it's a mistake, but I think people didn't realize that you're never actually alone. And it can be a really lonely process, whatever you're going through, whether it's friends or family or community or social media. You know, social media has its ups and downs, its positives, negatives, but you can find communities, or you are never alone. And I think that's a key message, because a lot of people feel like they're alone, but you aren't ever alone. And I think that's something that I think a lot of people did feel, that you are alone and there's no one there, but there actually is. But it's finding the right people, because, you know, it's finding the right people in your tribe. I think someone said that actually on one of my podcasts. I think they said, you need to find your tribe.
So it's really nice when you realize you don't have to be different to these people. There's like people that will respect you as you are. And just like embracing your own craziness first is kind of an essential part to then finding the people that will like embrace you back. Like the people that I connected with and stayed friends with over last year are all slightly nuts. And like, it's kind of, yeah, it's just like 20-year-old dude that's like a DJ who I met climbing. He's just finishing his degree. Bloody lovely. He's got like a banging Spotify profile. Jack Kai, the 3x Rubik's World champion, who I've kept in touch with from after he was on my show last year. And he's a total nutter who's just great to touch base with. Then the third guy is a friend here in the Netherlands who's an autistic Ironman athlete. And I'll go training with him sometimes, and it totally redefines my idea of what my maximum is, because I just feel like I'm going to vomit every time we train together. But more importantly, he's a savant who's memorized almost half of Wikipedia. And every time I talk with him, I'll learn something new. And it's so platonically attractive when someone can tell me the history about liquid soap or the energy output of an eagle compared to a bear. And he's so open-minded. If I state an idea as a fact and he has some clear evidence that I'm wrong, he won't tell me that I'm wrong and that I'm stupid. He'll be like, wow, Sam, I have not heard that information before. What data do you have on that? What are your sources? And I'll be like, yeah, I think I'm wrong. But anyway, before this becomes a tribute to my weird friends, the point is that to find your tribe, it really helps to relax into being yourself and just embracing your own weirdness. And I think one of the pushes to make peace with yourself and your dreams is, of course, nearly dying. So One thing I have always thought is that, like, it would be cool if everyone could nearly die once, as in it is actually a really good experience. It's just very impractical to make it happen. And even for myself, I would have preferred it to be slightly different, actually, in terms of if I could change something. Then I would have preferred to, like, drowned or something and then been brought back to life. Although it was handy being in hospital for, like, a long time with major issues. And it's super annoying having a leg that's one inch shorter than the other leg. And I kind of can't really do anything about that. But sometimes I think it's a good thing because it's a bit of a, like, a humbling experience. It's a constant reminder that I've nearly died. And maybe if I had drowned, I maybe wouldn't have noticed it so much, because I've nearly died a few times. And certainly the first time I didn't notice it that much, to be fair. If you could have spoken to them, have given them like a list of, like, these are the 60 ways that I've spoken to people who have nearly died and what's happened to them, which experience, if you had to choose one of them, would you have gone for?
That's actually a really interesting concept. Yeah, which one would you go for?
Because, like, some kind of lasting thing is handy. So yeah, like, when I was 16, I fell on the fence and, like, blood absolutely everywhere. And it was very, very stressful. It was the most stress I've ever been whilst nearly dying, easily. The other times I was very, like, happy about it. But afterwards, like, I went to hospital. They, like, sewed me back up. And within, like, a day, I was running around a festival being an idiot again. And feeling great. I don't think I felt any less invincible afterwards than I did beforehand. Whereas the other ones, like, definitely stuck with me a bit more. And I was a bit like, oh, damn. So, yeah, I do wonder what is the perfect level of experience for a near-death experience to make it, like, impactful. And obviously, it depends on the person as well.
You know what? It's not even, I think it wouldn't even be, like, in, you know, near death, just anything that just shakes your entire world. But even if you, like, break a leg, because then physically you can't do anything, you know, even if it's not necessarily, you know, in an accident way or in a near-death experience.
So I saw a guy that glued himself to a skateboard for 24 hours, for example, but you could wrap your legs up and just have to use a wheelchair for a month. And, like, it would radically change your worldview afterwards. Because, yeah, using a wheelchair myself for a month, I was like, oh my God, the wheelchair access is useless in all these places. And it's so hard to roll a wheelchair on any surface that isn't completely perfectly, like, horizontal. Slightest incline and you're just going all over the place. It's a nightmare. And there's no respect in these people that...
I was going to say, or even if you're on crutches. You know, I spent months on crutches. And believe me, it's an effort.
Joey. If you had to do, like, a school of life or resilience training, like, it would make sense to just put people on crutches for a week. As in, the only point of school is really to learn how to learn at this point, because most of the things you learn aren't that useful. Good. Anyway, what is one of the kindest things someone has ever done for you?
I don't want you to generalize it, but I'm the small gestures kind of person. And it can literally be a case of, if my friend pays for my coffee, they're like, no, it's on me today. And I'm like, but why? No, it's just on me today. Like, it can literally come down to things like that. Or I'll drop you home. You don't have to drop me home. I'll drop you home. It's fine. Even if it's an hour out of the way, I'll drop you home. I know that, again, that it was generalized, but I'm a small gestures person. And it's just, I notice things like that. You know, I'll always notice things like that with my family, with my friends, if I'm on a date, like, anything like that. Those are the little things that I pick up on. Maybe because, you know, it's how you mirror people. You know, usually what you see in other people. Maybe that's because I like to do that. You know, I like to do small gestures. I'm the kind of person that, you know, I'll walk past a shop, and if I see something that makes me think of someone, I'll take a picture and send it to them with no explanation. I'll just send them the picture. I'll just send them the picture. And I think even things like that, someone sends me a picture and they're like, oh, by the way, I saw this today. And even if I haven't spoken to them for months, I thought of you.
I think it's a great life hack, definitely.
That makes my day.
So the main reason I ask it is there's lots of ways that you can do really cool, nice, kind things for people that are just in front of you all the time and that you don't necessarily notice. And it's often these little, tiny, small things that are just opportunities that you just aren't taking because you aren't realizing that they're there. So just anything that brings it home to something that you could just practically do is always nice. So that was a very long list of practical things that you could go and do. And I've certainly been trying to send things to friends whenever I just thought about them. If I do see, like, something that I think a friend will really like, I will buy it for them if it's relevant outside of Christmas, or if I ever even do any form of present exchange with that person, like, it doesn't really matter. I'm like, if the person would really like it, it's okay. Assuming it's not huge.
But actually, on that, someone on my podcast, I remember someone telling me, because I think we were talking about small gestures and doing a random act of kindness. And they said that what they sometimes do is they'll pay for the person either before or behind them at like the drive-through in Starbucks or the drive-through at McDonald's, and they'll just pay for it. So when the person then gets there, they've already paid for it. And I was like, I really like that. So, you know, that's a random act of kindness for a complete stranger.
I remember one time where my mum paid for a train for some like guy and just like, I thought he was just like you, Sam. I was like, you could just pay for my train, you know, mum, that would be fine. And she's like, no. I was like, okay, that was nice. Thanks, mum. Although I'm not sure quite how this helps me. But anyway, lovely that you're doing nice things. But yeah, I do like just those sort of small things that make people remember that most humans are nice, because I think it's a fundamental fact that isn't really spread that much in news, etc., where you just hear about everything being terrible and wrong, or capitalism's just money-grabbing bastards, or everything is just bad in terms of these things. And you're like, well, humans are fundamentally actually quite nice. They maybe have made some wrong decisions due to lack of knowledge or a situation. There's very few people that are fundamentally evil or would do anything intentionally terrible. And it's good to remind people that we mostly enjoy doing nice things.
But it makes you realize that you matter. It doesn't matter how much healing you go through, how much self-love you go through, all these positive things you go through. At the end of the day, we are still human beings. We have emotions, we have feelings, and everyone needs a little bit of reassurance. And I feel like even things like that, it just shows you that you matter. Outside your little bubble of yourself, you matter, you know, to whoever it might be. And it's like a tiny bit of reassurance, like, oh yeah.
It's a massive life hack for, one, yourself, like love and acknowledgement of exactly what you said, that you matter, and also like more nice things happen to you when you do it. Like you said, like maybe it happens to you a lot because if you're doing it a lot, and yeah, it's like a direct karma. Like if people know that you're always going to be nice to them, like it's very easy for them to always be nice to you. Whereas if they know that you're always going to like count exactly like how much money you spent on your pint, etc., and come back to them with a bill afterwards, they're going to be like, do I really want to like go to the pub with him if it's going to be a problem? And yeah, it just definitely shows up in your life depending on how you show up. So thanks for that. I think a lovely message to end on, unless you have any other wise messages to end on.
Whatever you give out and however you perceive your life, whatever your thoughts matter. So whatever you give out to the world, you get back. So if you are going to constantly give out a lot of negativity and a lot of, you know, bad, in inverted commas, bad things, and you're always rude or whatever it might be, that's probably going to come back. Whereas if you do give out, you know, love and kindness, and I know that sounds really cliche, but if you do give out just good things happen. And I know a lot of people are like, yeah, but no, but really, like, the more good you give, like, good things really do happen. And I just think a reminder of that, if you've got a dream, just chase it. Like, no dream is too big for anybody. If someone else is doing it in the world, why can't you? Like, that person had a dream one day, and look at them. You know, if someone else is doing it, you can do it too, and maybe even better.
Strong message of growth mindset there. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Right. Well, that was such a cool interview on the concept of growth mindset and how we can build that through near-death experiences and how else we might replicate those lessons. And if you found Talia interesting or the Sound of Earth podcast, it's called I Got Back Up. And if you like tales of near-death experiences, that is the place for you. If you enjoyed anything from this episode, please do share it with a friend. That is how we grow. And if you are feeling ultra generous or bored or want to escape doing your actual tasks, then you can leave me a good rating on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, as I'm sure you're aware. If you do have any questions for me, or if you want to reach out, you can drop that in the comments or email me at growthmindsetpodcast@gmail.com. And on that, remember that life is too short to put off your big dreams, as we've been very much talking about this episode. So whatever they are, start pursuing them and don't put off happiness behind some future goals, because that is a great way to not be happy. So be kind to yourself, and whilst you're at it, be kind to someone else.